Unit, episode 595 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and, that's what a Volvic Kaleidoscope looks like.
And this is Bronson from Australia, and you won't hear me saying this very often, but God, I wish there were Reavers.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of looking at it. We are going to be going into the bottom and top shows for the week. But before we do any of that, Edmund, I believe that there is some kind of disclaimer that you need to give.
Absolutely. As ever, we will discuss whatever we feel like about these episodes. So if you haven't seen them, you will most likely be spoiled. But as always, we try and wait a week, 10 days or so before we do that to you.
Indeed, and we are going to go ahead and start, as always, with our bottom three in a rough order of how well, not so well they did. How do you want to put it there? These shows were all dead average or below, so we're definitely getting a little bit closer to what is typical for our weekly fare here as we get deeper into the summer. But we're going to start off with a show that, hey, it managed not to be at the bottom of the list this time. Everyone... clap. Falling Skies, Season 5, Episode 3, Hatchlings. The Second Mass makes a discovery about the source for a seemingly endless supply of enemy forces. Elsewhere, Tom's leadership spreads to remaining human militias. Hal helps Maggie on a personal mission, and Tom must make an agonizing choice. And this one, as I said, kind of came in dead average. But let's see, we had some comments here from Gary, who gave it a 7.5. That's impressive for him. He said, enjoyed a lot of the action and tension. The girl dying was too telegraphed. Yes, and that girl would be the character played by Mira Sorvino. And my comment about that was maybe the writers realized that no one in the audience remembered where she came from or what her purpose was. So they gave her one, posthumously.
Yes, which was basically to turn Pope back into bad Pope and go all vengeful angry, apparently.
Indeed. And yeah, I don't know where that's going to go, but it was a little more interesting than usual, but...
Yeah, although, when they mentioned the militias there, I mean, I did laugh out loud at the idea, given how sort of haphazard their victories and tactics have been, that all these militias would really be rallying around calling themselves the Mason Militias.
That sounds like a really lame Metallica cover
band. Sounds like a really lame spinoff of Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah, there you go.
Which would be better. Yes. He says not having watched Falling Skies in about two seasons.
You're not wrong.
And you're not missing much either.
Maybe it needs to pull. It needs to do what our hypothetical Gotham spinoff is doing. And just go a comedic direction.
Oddly enough, this season is almost a full half point. A half point. Anyway, a half point higher than last season, and actually middle of the pack as far as our scores go for this. For the series, so it's not doing as bad as it could.
Give it time. I'm seeing the cracks already.
All right. But they have less time to mess it. Okay, whatever. The next show here we have is Dark Matter, Season 1, Episode 5. Episode 5. The crew are hired by their handler to salvage a seemingly deserted space freighter, a reclaim op that appears to be straightforward until a deadly cargo is uncovered, and they are forced to fight for their lives. And this one came in at an average of 6.5. Oddly enough, Gary gave this an 8, saying, and this is why it's odd, they didn't finish another job? When is the crap going to hit the fan and someone come after them? Gary, that's usually considered to be a negative point about an episode. Yes. Why that is included in the notes next to an 8, I'm not sure. But I will say this. Brunstelm, you mentioned Reavers?
Yeah. Come on. Man. Look, here's what you do. Don't watch this episode. Go grab your Firefly DVDs, pop in the episode Bushwhacked, and just watch it. But imagine that there was no... there was the completely unimaginative shoot it like cinematography, and a cast where the best actor... is a the actor who's giving it the most is a runner up in Canadian Idol. This just I was already like going into it like I hadn't been impressed with the last episode or two. I just thought any goodwill I had from the first couple episodes had just completely gone away. The actors weren't really giving it anything. The sci-fi universe just felt really derivative and also really small somehow. The character dynamics were either very stale or very stupid. Honestly, more and more it's reminding me of the first series of Torchwood. And then they come along and they do an episode that is just so blatantly trying to be a particular episode of Firefly.
Well, what's worse is...
And just don't invite that comparison. This is like that episode of Dexter where he goes up against a cannibal.
The problem
like,
here...
Don't invite the comparison. Don't make me... It's the rule of... What is it? The rule of homage or referencing or something like that. It's like, don't make the audience think about something better that they could be watching.
The problem that I have is that on the exact same night, you have another show that pretty much referenced the same, like a Firefly episode, and did it much better than Dark Matter did. So
it
just
which show
like,
is this? I think I'm gonna miss it.
Oh, I was speaking of Killjoys, but we'll get to that.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay.
Anyway, yes, let's move on from there. And unfortunately, this next show, I know I was going to join you, Edmund, and I will.
Okay.
It's been a crazy week.
That's all right.
Emphasis on crazy. Let's go ahead, though, and name check this one, at least.
Absolutely. This was The Return of Masters of Sex, Season 3, Episode 1, Parliament of Owls. Season 3 begins with Masters and Johnson facing the press for the first time as they prepare to publish their study. As they do so, they recall last year's summer vacation when Bill was finishing work on their book, Virginia was facing parenting struggles, and Libby was pulling herself out from beneath a deep depression. I gave this a 6.5, mentioned in recent episodes that they were having this issue last season of having to sort of make certain stuff up because in the source material and all the primary documents they don't necessarily know about all of the people in the Masters and Johnson family and universe, and unfortunately there is now more of the same going on. The episode itself, I found the structure rather disjointed, where they kept with the way they were going back and forth between this press conference and the summer vacation, where they were trying to sort of highlight the odd blended nature of the Masters and Johnson's respective families, and then we have this bizarre disclaimer at the end of the episode, basically letting us know that 4 out of the 5 children we have been watching are fictitious, which kind of made sense of the fact that some of the situations that they were in was feeling rather stale and stereotypical, it's just highlighting for me that this show does best when it tries to stick to the facts, ma'am, and not so well when they are trying to create the family dynamics and social dynamics from whole cloth. So not for me anyway, not an auspicious start to the season. One thing I was grateful for, I know I've mentioned that I avoid previews now, but Showtime has been blasting ads for this across all of the various CBS Viacom venues, I think probably to highlight and publicize the new Showtime streaming service. And there was this kiss between Libby, Bill's wife, and Virginia that seemed to intimate, they've gone really far in sexual experimentation. And thankfully, it wasn't quite what they were pushing it to be. So I was at least grateful for that. But I will be hoping to see better things down the line from this show.
Yeah, like I said, I'll catch up and we can probably commiserate. I'll play the role of the person who hasn't been watching.
Right.
For once. But it sounds like this is a good palate cleanser after, like I said, some of the other stuff I've been watching. Let's move on to perhaps better territory here as we go on to the top 3 for the week. And the first one here on the list is jumping all the way up to our above average 8 is Defiance, Season 3, Episode 6, Where the Apples Fall. Nolan and Berlin pursue the Tars after their connection to the Votanis Collective is exposed. At the same time, Alak comes to grips with his future as a father. And like I said, this one came in at an above average 8. And in general, I just feel like, yeah, this season's a lot more focused. It's a lot darker. There's more layers going on here. And just the personal consequences for the characters are much higher, it seems. A lot of the things that they were trying to introduce last season that didn't quite work are working better now.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, the plotting is, as you say, is much more direct. Things are happening much faster. I love the whole twist of Alec getting back and basically just outing his parents immediately. Other than the fact that, yes, obviously he had quite a bit of anger and hatred towards Stama for for dispatching his wife. But yeah, the fact that they're not holding back and stringing things along in terms of the threats that they're facing, the whole little storyline with the general and his wife showing up and using that to basically just really heighten the whole sense of just how committed and dangerous and crazy he is was even though, yes, it does seem to have, it does seem to have been taking them a little while to start this attack, but they are getting there, and they have certainly established him as quite a formidable and interesting character.
Mm. Indeed. Second on our list here, and I do want to move on just because I'm eager to get Bronze Thumb's thoughts on this after three episodes. Coming in at our number two slot, also at an above average 8, is Mr. Robot, Season 1, Episode 3, Debug.mkv. Elliot tries to lead a normal life, but can't escape F society. Gideon, meanwhile, grows suspicious, and Tyrell plays dirty. Well, when you've seen the episode, that recap is just a little disturbing, but there we are. So, again, we all gave this one an 8, but Bronstum, your thoughts on Mr. Robot so far?
First things first, can we all agree that Mr. Robot is a figment of Elliot's imagination?
Yes.
Good. Moving on. From minute one, I've been really enjoying this show, and really the only bug with it I've really had is just that it seems transparently obvious where they're going with that particular quote unquote twist. It's a fantastic cyberpunk drama. Like it just oozes that genre in all the best possible ways, and I. In a show that didn't have the great kind of atmosphere and the interesting characters that this one has, I would be a bit upset the fact that they're taking so long to spool out the plot, and the fact that they're doing like something that even shows I really really love have done in their first seasons, and it's kind of annoyed me, which is like a really quote unquote actiony plot heavy bang 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 kind of first episode, and then immediately back off that pace afterwards. Yeah, other shows it might annoy me, but this one it's really getting up to its elbows in all that great cyberpunk sort of stuff, and just letting us see the consequences of the lifestyles of these characters and the social implications of the way that they use or abuse technology. I find Elliot to be a really really fascinating protagonist. Just the idea that he speaks to the audience as though we are his imaginary friend.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like that's just like that. I find that just insanely interesting and a great way to fold in a kind of fourth wall breaking voiceover sort of thing. And aside from being like really really clever and really inventive, it just gets us deeper into what's going on with this character. This character has some really severe issues and is trying to work them out and take out his frustrations in ways that are sometimes we can appreciate and other times we think like, oh, you're going down a bad road, buddy. And yeah, he's surrounded by a really good cast, a lot of interesting characters who maybe not as well developed, but then again, they're really not like Elliot is really front and center pretty much all the time. It seems like there are very few moments where we get away from him. I love the show. I love the style of it. I love this episode. The whole his interpretation, I guess you'd say, of normality. And his attempt to sort of falsify all these things he doesn't really feel or understand. And then meanwhile, all these other interesting threads are playing out. The stuff with Tyrell, whose name, I'm sure, is just totally, completely an accident. Not a Blade Runner reference at all.
No, not at all.
Again, that kind of... yeah, I don't have enough good things to say about this episode, to say about this show, with the one, like I said, the one big thing that's sort of preventing me from maybe enjoying it more is it seems like they're so transparently setting up this quote-unquote twist. Like, I feel like I can just see it coming in my way. And the problem is that when it's something like this, and I've seen other I've seen this happen with other stories and whatnot, is that because of how far out we're seeing this, there is absolutely no way that they can do it well, because either they play into exactly what we expect, like they play into all the things they've been setting up that we've seen from miles and miles away, and we don't find it surprising or amazing or anything, or they take a complete left turn. They go in a completely different direction that has not been set up in the slightest, and we feel like the show is cheating in order to shock us, which gets us offside in a completely different way.
It is a little bit of an obvious thing, and that's the one little detail that's kind of, you know, worming around in the back of my head when I'm watching the show. It's like, how are they gonna? They can't make this a reveal so much as a just on the nose, almost, you guys all know this, right? And just let it play out. Because like you said, if they try and make more of it than they already have, it's just going to blow the whole thing apart. But I kind of like, they've got to just keep threading this needle. Just keep playing the game where you're winking at the audience constantly, even as you continue to just go down this guy's rabbit hole. And yeah, yeah, wasn't the reference I was really looking to do right there, but okay.
Yeah, because presumably, I mean, you know, so long as this is what he is doing, I mean, Mr. Robot's going to be there, so it's not like they can suddenly do a oh no, he's not there moment. But I know one thing I particularly liked in terms of obviously Elliot is the main focus, but with them putting a little more focus on Terrell, I liked the whole idea of Terrell not being this he wants to be a Masters of the Universe type, but he, in terms of his situation, he's nowhere close to being there yet. It was partially because we got to see that Michael Christopher is playing his boss after playing the fabulous Truxton Spangler on Rubicon and getting drinks thrown in his face by Angelica Houston on Smash three times, if I remember right. Having Michael Christopher come in certainly portends some very very fun shenanigans at Evil Corp. Even though Terrell himself was, you know, yes, I mean, it is rather gleefully over the top in terms of being a very twisted and sadistic and violent man. But I was rather intrigued after what they'd introduced with him in the previous episode to find that yes, he's possibly a little henpecked and has ambitions beyond his means at the moment, and so that's some intriguing conflicts and details to be worked out.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I'm really hoping that they manage to keep this show at its level of quality and that Bronze Thumb, your fears are not quite as realized.
Yeah, it's just like you said, it sticks in the back of the head, the fact that a show this clever, this smart in the way it's could be trying to set us up in such an obvious way.
Yeah, yeah.
I hope that they can... I mean, admittedly, we're only about three episodes into the season, which I think is supposed to be 10 episodes overall. Hopefully what they're going to be doing is threading in some new things. Like I just hope that they can figure out a way to not be so obvious and simple.
You know what the scary part of this is? There's probably a lot of people in the audience that really haven't figured this out yet.
True.
Yeah, and I will also we mentioned Dexter last episode, and so I will just mention that at least they're doing it a heck of a lot better than Edward James Olmos in whichever season of Dexter that was, where we all knew immediately. And
it was season six, and yeah, from minute one you knew.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us to what may be, for many people, a relatively predictable result in terms of the top show for the week, especially since we definitely made sure that we got Bronze Thumb scoring in this time around. And it is, in fact, Hannibal Season 3, Episode 6, Dulce. Will and Jack reunite and renew their alliance, yet Jack questions Will's true loyalty. Meanwhile, Hannibal and Bedelia sense their time in Florence is reaching its end as Hannibal plots his final stand, and Mason Verger plans Hannibal's capture. And like I said, this came in at the top at a 9, so in the exceptional spot. Bronstone, why don't you get started on this one, too?
We're still knee-deep in the third Hannibal Lecter novel. I think it seemed pretty transparent to me from the get-go of this season, but I think there are probably people who didn't quite realize where this Hannibal and Bedelia in Florence storyline was going until the previous episode when we had Parzi and Hannibal confront each other. I believe that was the last episode.
Yes.
The fact that this continues to be a really brilliant reimagining of a novel that was not that good. The best thing about that novel really was the Florence stuff. And they're playing out the storyline really, really well. After a really action-packed episode, we're getting more into pace and movement, and it feels like the show is moving faster than it's been moving since the previous season. I was genuinely tense for a number of times, like the last confrontation between Hannibal and Bedelia, Hannibal and Will's first meeting in the art gallery, and then that end scene where I there was a part of me that genuinely thought that Hannibal was going to go through with it, that Will Graham was about to get all Ray Liotta'd.
Yes.
Which is a reference for people who've seen the movie, the film Hannibal, which was also not very good, in my opinion.
Left a bad taste in our mouth, yeah. That pun brought to you by Gary in absentia. Anyway.
Yes. Yeah, this was, it just moved, and it was constantly taking me from one really heightened emotion to another. It felt like Hannibal has a lot of the show Hannibal has a lot of the a lot of operatic a very operatic quality to it. It's very larger than life. It's very over the top. Aside, you know, and this is on top of the huge gothic horror influence. This is really getting into these episodes have been really getting into Hannibal in its most operatic. There was some. Yeah, it's hard for me to single out particular bits of the episode.
Well, that's understandable because this episode in particular, which for me, I mean, you weren't around when I wasn't downgrading it hugely, but I was taking a couple of ticks off the last couple of episodes. But with this episode, I just felt like they were so much embracing the sort of over the top surreal elements, and certainly just visually, this episode, was quite extraordinary in terms of the way they were evoking Bedelia's sort of descent into medicinal delirium, shall we say. And
That was fantastic. It's not that Gillian Anderson Gillian Anderson's been fantastic this whole season.
Yes.
This whole show, I'm so glad they got her on as a regular.
Absolutely.
For season 3, but she she really got to stretch her acting muscles a bit more in this episode by playing what she's been playing before, just that really interesting, intricate relationship with Hannibal, and then getting to do the whole mushroom samba with Will and Jack, and then with the police, and playing the same thing in very different ways depending on who she's talking to. Like with the police, she's being very earnest about her cover story. But with Jack and Will, it's very much with a sly wink.
Oh, yes.
Of, as long as I don't say anything too incriminating, there is nothing you can do. I know that you know, but there's nothing. Yeah, but there's nothing you can do. It helps build even more. We buy even more the fact that she could have been with Hannibal Lecter for a year, and almost. You know, a whole have this whole psychological Scheherazade sort of thing going of just being so competent and interesting he wouldn't want to put an end to her.
Mm-hmm.
She can stay alive and whatnot until this episode where she's got an exit strategy and she knows that if Hannibal is interrupted, that he's not going to just simply kill her.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, and then on the flip side of the coin, that whole Bloom Verger merger, which was you know, has certainly seemed to be setting certainly setting up a potential end game or exit strategy on the other side of things. So you know, so yeah, being hung up like meat for Mason's delectation, as we would expect anyway, may not be quite the final solution that it appears to be at the end of the episode. But yeah, I mean, this certainly got me licking my chops just to really stretch the culinary metaphors for how in fact they're going to resolve all this, and just the fact that it looks like it's going to be a continued visual delight to watch.
You can tell, yeah. Anytime that Hannibal's gonna have a sex scene, they get in Vincenzo Natale.
Yes.
And it's always twisted and visually fascinating. It kind of surprised me that they went there with Alana. But it was a good kind of surprise. It was I didn't see it coming, but then when they sort of revealed that okay. That makes sense. I can see that. I can see the why these two characters would bond and why they would come together, because they're essentially both sharing in a very similar kind of trauma. They've really been like very, very psychologically violated by these people, and you know, we can see them sort of colluding and scheming and whatnot to try and get not necessarily, an aspect of revenge, an aspect of justice, and I think an aspect of closure on these people. I also really like the fact that this season of Hannibal has found better ways to use the character of Alana Bloom as part of the narrative, like not just in terms of like she's able to fill in some of the role that Clarice Starling did in the books, since they still don't have the rights to that character,
yes.
But also. I mean, a big problem I had with it was one of the few problems I had with the second season of Hannibal, but it was a big one, which was that it felt like all the female characters got marginalized, partially by bad luck. The fact that I think the fact that they didn't have Gillian Anderson for most of season two is kind of what led to it, because they had of the female characters, they had two that were unavailable for a lot of the season, and then one of them who the plan had always been that this character would. Fall on the altar of Hannibal, so to speak, to really help drive home just what a just how bad he is, and how bad he's to be a further surprise on that road. And the result was that basically we were left with one female character whose entire arc for most of the season was essentially just to be a love interest.
Yeah,
and it was it was a disappointing thing to do with a character who had been so strong and so interesting in the first season. And it also kind of gets into that problem of. And I'm totally blanking on who said it, but someone put it really, really well. Just the idea, like, if you only have one character of a, like, if you only have one, and since we're talking about the female characters in Hannibal, if you only have one female character, they become a representation of all women in a story, and therefore, and that is inherently problematic, because there's no right way to do that. And I think Hannibal sort of fell into that trap, partially by accident and partially because. They sort of mishandled that, but yeah, my point is they've been handling it a lot better this season.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, last season where myself included. I mean, there were a lot of people who did not like the fact that Alana seemed to so easily slip under Hannibal's spell. To bring her back now with much more agency as she started articulating an actual plan to go after these monsters was very nice to see.
Hmm. So, anything more to say about Hannibal? Because I don't know that there's any more words left in the dictionary.
The one sort of strike against it that I'll give was that ending was very abrupt.
Yes. Yeah, that was one of those cases where I had to rewind a couple of times, thinking like, wait a minute, did I miss something? It's like, no, okay, you just went straight from that to that.
Yeah, and I do understand the the reason why. Because leaving on a cliffhanger of, like, it's the two main kind of cliffhangers is is, you know, there's the one of like, are they going to get out of this? And then there's, how are they going to get out of this? And I think the second one is a lot more effective than the first, because, I mean, if they had left this episode on Hannibal buzzsawing into Will Graham's skull,
yes,
there would not have been, like, it was a shocking image. I was genuinely very tense, but if they left the episode there, I just would have, like, okay, something's going to happen and he's going to get out of it.
Right.
I wouldn't have been nearly as invested as I was when all of a sudden they're in the clutches of Mason Verger. And now my questions are, you know, I'm genuinely asking, oh, how did they get out of here? And how did they get in this situation? And how are they going to get out of this situation? Like, that's a more effective way to hook someone into the next episode.
Yes.
Well, what do we have left for Hannibal at this point? Seven episodes?
Yes.
Seven episodes. The next episode is from the end of the arc, I guess. Like, there's a very... Season 2 had something a bit similar, but there's a season 3.1 and season 3.2. And 3.2 is going to be the Red Dragon arc. So next episode will presumably bring at least some kind of closure to some of the storylines that have been going on. And having read the books and seen the movies and all that, and knowing that they are adapting this particular storyline, I can make some educated guesses about what's going to happen to some of the characters.
Yeah, I bet you can. So we're going to go from our bottom three and top three. And while we still have Bronstam here, we'll try and get through some of these other shows too. So we'll see where we go from here. But at any rate, also showing this past week, we had Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Season 1, Episode 5, Arabella. Jonathan Strange's remarkable magic helps England win the Battle of Waterloo, after which Strange returns home, hoping for a peaceful new life. But the gentleman's scheme for revenge wrecks all of his and Arabella's plans, leaving Jonathan Strange a ruined man. And this one came in at an average of 8. And, mainly, I'm just really happy that I didn't read the book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I definitely am concurring with my decision to stop where I did.
Yeah, because this one was kind of gut-wrenching, and it would have been not as effective knowing it was coming.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and also I must give them kudos for the fact that yes, I think actually in terms of when it appeared in the UK, it was just about right at the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo. So, nicely done, guys.
Well played.
Yes. But yeah, that was definitely some twists and turns I was not seeing coming, and it just demonstrated that this obviously was adapted from a very good book in terms of how these dynamics between the two of them have twisted and turned, and now brought them back together in ways I did not suspect, and certainly the whole idea of him pleading with Norrell to, you know, no use that magic that brought to that can bring people back, when of course he doesn't know the crucial thing of, you know, yes, except for the fact that that magic that he used in fact created the person who just took your wife away, and that's why he doesn't really want to keep delving into it. So.
Yeah, this show is the one that I watch, and my wife occasionally looks at me and goes, "This is really interesting, and I wish I had seen this from the beginning." And then, you know, my daughter will walk in and go, "What is with the creepy guy?"
Yes,
and I was like, "Yeah, that's how I feel too,
Mr. Whitehair." Yes.
Anywho, moving on to the show that we were referencing earlier, we have Killjoys Season 1, Episode 4, Vessel. The Killjoys find their real rhythm as a trio while navigating the ugly side of, Kreshi politics, as they transport a group of gorgeous surrogates in a bullet-riddled ride from a Badlands fortress. Or as I like to call it, Heart of Gold.
See, I was going to say Killjoys Fury Road.
Exactly, yes.
Kind of both. But anyway... There is a common thread here, but what I like here is that this is essentially what, building on the comments that we were making, Edmund, with Gary last week, on the previous two episodes, where Killjoys is doing all of the world building and character development at the same time versus a show like Dark Matter that is doing really neither at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's yielding dividends, as they say. Bronstam, again, this is, I think, the first time that we really get your commentary on this show. You're a little bit less, you took a little bit less of a shine for this one, but it didn't take it down too much. We're still coming in at an average of 7.88.
Mm. Yeah, it's a. I'm really enjoying Killjoys. It's going for the fun. Dark Matter could really take a lesson of just if when in doubt, just go for something fun. Go for a fun action scene. Go for some fun dialogue, some fun character interaction. Just stuff like that. And even when the story's lagging, even if I don't care that much about the secondary characters, which unfortunately tends to happen a lot in this show. It is not by coincidence reminding me a lot of the first season of Lost Girl. I can still fall back on the just enjoying this group of characters and enjoying the tone and the style. Like, it's just good to have something that's really really like it's a really fun space opera. I'm enjoying the ride, even if I'm enjoying the ride enough that I'm not just sort of like hunkered down picking holes in things, even if there are bits of the episodes that I'm not as into.
Yeah. Right now, as far as the Friday night shows for sci-fi go, I usually start with Dark Matter just to get kind of a start to the watching, I guess. Then I move on to Killjoys and really kind of dig in with Defiance. But it's one of those things where if Dark Matter doesn't come back, I'm really not going to be sad. If Killjoys gets canceled, I would be a little upset.
Yeah, definitely.
Because Killjoys is fun. Like you said, Bronstump, it's fun. It's not trying to be more than what it is, quite honestly. And shows like that aren't a bad thing. So, yeah. Speaking of a show that is really just being what it is and putting it out there is The Last Ship, Season 2, Episode 5, Achilles. And catch up. Okay. Chandler and his crew duel against a rogue British naval officers manning a nuclear-powered submarine. Meanwhile, Slattery, interrogates a mercenary to learn more about a hospital ship, and a dangerous game of cat and mouse ensues. And this one came in at an average of 7.83, so just a very small tick below Killjoys. And Gary gave this one an average 7. He said, I really enjoy the twist in this episode about the cure being attacked, as well as the takeover of Europe. Okay, now wait a second. You gave a negative comment and go. Anyway. I like this a lot more. I gave it an 8.5. I love this twist. I know that it's 5 episodes into the season, but I kept on asking myself, what are they going to do to kind of continue the story? Because the first few episodes told me that the story was more or less over. Yeah. And then this happens.
They found the cure, yes.
And the next thing that came to mind was, hey, look, it's Crusade all over again.
Yes. It's the middle of the second season, and they found
right.
the cure.
Yes. So here we are. It's hard for me not to root for the show when that happens.
Now you almost make me want to watch it.
It's basically take Crusade in its rough story arc, as explained by JMS in the past, and take that and in the best way possible, mix it with Michael Bay military porn.
Yeah.
And it works.
Yeah, and really, really good military porn too. I mean,
yes.
Gary mentioned last episode, how this is one of those shows that members of the armed forces watch because they get it right. And certainly, the whole cat and mouse between the ship and the sub, and them, going to quiet levels, and run silent, run deep. The submarine World War II movie from I think back in the 50s. It was reminding me of all those sorts of things. But then as well, this whole twist of. Having the people who are immune basically banding together into a cult to, decide that God decided we should be here and so nobody should be cured and we're just going to try and wipe everything out was a wonderful twist. I sort of felt like losing the Russians last season was a loss, but replacing them with these guys is trading up as far as I'm concerned.
Mm. Yeah. Let's see here. Moving on from there, we have a show that you guys are going to have to talk about.
Yes.
True Detective, Season 2, Episode 4, Down Will Come. In the face of corruption and bent politicians, damaged cops for Velcoro... Oh, forget it. I'm going to do this one.
Damaged cops, Velcoro, Bezzarides, and Woodruff find it difficult to keep the case straight.
Yes. Those people. Yeah. And this one came in at an average of 7.5. Bronstum giving it an 8. In the following commentary? Bronstum?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, now.
Yes.
I'm not sure I've had a chance to talk about this show.
No, you haven't. Yes, please. Weigh in.
On the whole, I'm not enjoying it as much as the first season. Because I think the first season had going for it the fact that it was doing something that you'd never really saw in TV and doing it with a kind of a very unique kind of artistry. This one has the artistry, but it doesn't have the freshness, both because we watched the first season and we know kind of what True Detective is going for, and also because it's going for a genre that's very familiar. Last season we had all this kind of cosmic horror without the cosmic, in a sense, and this is more of a hard-boiled crime story. This is something that, like, you know, it's more in the Michael Mann kind of wheelhouse. So if you're a fan of something like, it reminds me a lot of Heat in some ways, while still having that very True Detective kind of grisly, no holds barred kind of crime feel to it. And yeah, I think that's just why it's not necessarily hitting as strong. I think if it wasn't, it's still really good, but it suffers from kind of being under the shadow of season one. As for this episode specifically, I liked the emphasis on Frank. I feel like they didn't give Frank much to do at the very beginning of the season, and they're slowly beefing his role up. And it's good to see Vince Vaughn kind of getting to play more dramatic. My sense of Vince Vaughn is that he started out as a more dramatic actor and kind of fell into comedy as part of this frat pack of actors. And I don't know. I always like seeing someone kind of get you know, someone from that in a certain mold, try their hand at doing something else and be really good at it. So yeah, I thought he had a really good run in this episode. Him throwing his weight around, being, you know, getting all crime boss with everyone. It worked really well. I'd like getting to see Velcoro be a bit more sensitive, a bit more friendly, a bit more likable, I guess, than we've necessarily seen him all season. And he really had to kind of commit to being a police detective. He had a perfectly good opportunity to get out and to get into a line of work that he's probably a bit better suited for and would probably pay a lot more and would do more for him as a person. And instead he gets to commit to being on the side of the angels, even if he's not one, to borrow a phrase, in the same way that Frank is kind of committing to really being on the wrong side of all this. We also sort of get a few big things in the Woodrow story, who, as much as I still not that fond of Taylor Kitsch, I'm surprised he still has a career after he had Battleship and John Carter back to back. And I think he's just a very wooden actor, a very wooden presence, but it's kind of working for this character who is very, very uptight, very,
very repressed. Yes.
Very repressed. It reminds me of the things that people were saying about Brett Dalton in the first season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. What people were saying as opposed to what he was actually doing. Namely the fact that they've taken an actor who's not got a very not got a very broad range and given him a character that he's very, very well suited to. It's like a lot of Keanu Reeves roles. I don't think Keanu Reeves is a particularly great actor, but he's good at a few particular things, and if you give him a role that suits him, he'll knock it out of the park. In general, I like the fact that we spend most of this episode getting the characters sort of getting even further towards each other, instead of just working together and being in one another's orbit. They're developing relationships of some nature, and then we get the end sequence.
Yes,
it's. And again, it kind of gets back to the problem that this season is having, is that it's under the shadow of that first season. This sequence is fantastic. Like, it's so well shot, it's so well directed, it's exciting, it's dynamic, it's bloody, it's shocking and it's horrific. But the whole time, in the back of my mind, it's like, it's not quite that one-off. From season one.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 I mean that's sort of the issue I've been having, is that, you know, no, it's it's not standing up to the to, you know, not grabbing me the way season one did. And certainly with that sequence, I mean, I had absolutely the same reaction of, you know, yeah, guys, that was good, but, you know, but it's not you know, yeah, you know, no cut, steady, you know, Steadicam, getaway through the housing complex. I almost feel like, you know, they would have been better served, you know, not doing something that, you know, was quite so obviously analogous to that. I guess for me, the biggest down point is I'm not warming to Frank's character and his whole arc. That's why I came in at a 7 as opposed to your 8. But I have realized that part of it is I'm finding his whole story very similar to Ray Donovan, which I'd already given up on after the end of the first season. I mean, it just started its third season, but he's more of a straight out criminal than Ray is. It's also just that whole thing of as opposed to that, you know, that sort of, you know, at least the way it was initially introduced, that whole sort of pseudo mystical stuff that was going on in season one and in season two, it's just sort of standard, you know, small city corruption and police corruption, and certainly Colin Farrell and Rachel McAdams. I've been quite enjoying the way, you know, their performances and the way their characters are going. But it does feel much more familiar and gussied up with the fancier directorial choices and cinematography. It's not feeling like transcendent TV like season one at least started out as. And while I was certainly not as down on the finale as some people were, I thought that it actually made quite a bit of sense given who those characters were. But I guess that's sort of the chance you take with this new model of continuing series that are actually anthologies. You're gonna have great stories, and you're gonna have ones that just aren't necessarily as compelling.
It's not having the problem of a second season of a TV show. It's having the problem of a second novel.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm reminded of more and more as we talk is that we've talked about previously on the show the book Ready Player One, which I loved.
Yes,
by Ernest Cline. His second book is coming out very soon, or was just released, and the early reviews have been coming in, and they haven't been that good. People are just sort of like, oh, it's kind of doing the same thing again, but not as good. It's not as fresh. I don't find these characters quite as interesting. It's like, and they're fairly typical problems that you sort of find with a second novel. That an author puts out, like they have something that comes out and it's fresh and it goes gangbusters, and then they do their second thing and it's not quite as fresh because maybe they put all their they spent more time on the first one, or sort of put a bit more passion into it, or something like that, or just there's all kinds of reasons. But yeah, the second thing comes out and it doesn't quite live up to it, even if it is perfectly good in its own right, and that's exactly what this season of True Detective is like. You had J. Michael Straczynski, about 6-7 years after him, the guy whose name I'm forgetting, but who created The Sopranos, talking about bringing creating the whole novel for television format.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, 15, 20 years later, we're finding that TV is having is running into the same problems that novels tend to have. It's kind of interesting to think about it in that perspective. But yeah, getting back to True Detective, I am enjoying this season. It is very solid. I love a good hard-boiled crime story, but it lacks the freshness. I've seen hard-boiled crime stories on TV before. I hadn't seen a cosmic horror story quite like the first seasons.
Yes,
I think that's, and personally, I think that's a big part of it.
Hmm. All good points. Because yeah. Everything that you guys were saying was actually giving me exactly that impression. And in fact, I believe, Edmund, when you were talking about the previous episode last time, or at least one of the episodes last week, you kind of said similar things, where it was just the second time around, it seems to be missing something. That there's that layer of freshness that's just not there anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think what we're going to do is go ahead and end this particular show. And when we come back next episode, we'll finish out this week's list of shows. And then we have an actual listener topic to get into. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review. So let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.